Well, I enjoy old fairy tales, and I think about them often. I hope that you do, too. They're an important part of our common heritage. They're packed tight with treasure, like the chests in the witch's cottage. You can go back to them time and time again and always find new things to think about and new ways to think about them. Here's Joan Lindbergh's poem, The Disputed History of Hansel and Gretel, from her collection Paraphernalia. It's another angle on the story. And so they lived happily ever after among their precious stones and pearls. The miller's wife didn't mean anything as she watched them walking to school, but she couldn't help wondering why no one else had ever found the site. "Did you ever see it?" she asked. "That edible house? That oven?" The innkeeper had known an old woman who lived in the woods, a kindly soul, their grandmother. He shook his head as they went past. "The little devils," he said. "They bumped her off for her pearls." The pair grew taller. The trees cast ever longer shadows. Youths shouted after them as they went about their work. "Oi, Hansel! Show us your grandmother. Hey, Gretel, give us a pearl." They kept their heads down and never answered back. The village became a town. Deep inside the forest, axes split trunks and skulls. And now they had kids of their own. Hansel would always insist that his only tell him nice things when they came home from school. "Be happy," he said. "You're lucky. Luckier than you realize." Gretel wrapped hers up layer upon layer till their faces disappeared halfway into spring. "Stay close," she said. "It's dark. Darker than you could know." I can't think of a better poem or story to help us get ready for Halloween in 10 days. Let's sing. Hymn number 73, Chant for the Seasons, and we'll just sing the autumn part. Well, do you remember the first time you went trick-or-treating? You remember? It's a real question. No? Do you remember your first costume? Okay, what was it? Tana, you're nodding. A hobo. That was a pretty...
Back in the days when you didn't buy costumes in the store.
Ah, okay. Okay, yeah, hobo. That was a favorite. Little bandana. A little cork. Rub a little cork in your face. Okay. Yeah. Anybody else?
A rabbit.
Homemade. So Sharon was a rabbit. Homemade costume. Right? Ears about this long.
A Mexican hat dancer.
A Mexican hat dancer. Please, a little description. Okay, so you wore the hat.
Uh-huh. And my mother sewed a bright canary yellow outfit with a fringe. I think she wanted girls.
So she got to express that in your Halloween costume. Others?
I was a baseball player.
Baseball player? Yeah, how many people wanted to put your costume on again the next day or whenever you could? Yeah, yeah. Amber?
Yeah, a ghost wrapped in a bed sheet.
A ghost wrapped in a bed sheet. A classic, a true classic. Any others? Yeah, Lee?
I was an angel with wings made out of coat hangers, and it was just so wrong on so many levels.
I think you could all hear her. Oh, and I, of course, was a devil. Mom had a girl, but my costume included tights, and they couldn't get me to wear them to school. So, yeah, I would not wear the red tights to school. I think I did wear them at night. Did you go out alone, or did a parent go with you? Anybody? A parent? Two parents, anybody?
Siblings.
Oh, older siblings.
Girl lived at the end of the block.
Girl down at the end of the block would go along. If it was a parent, how many had mom? How many had dad? What kind of... Both. Some had both parents. Older brother or sister? Okay, some older brother and sisters. And did you take your own kids out? Or did you let them go alone? Took them out. Anybody let them go alone?
There was no trick or treat when I was a kid.
You just tricked. You just tricked. I've heard that. This is, we're going back a ways. Just a bunch of country kids causing mischief in costume. This sounds like a lot of fun. I heard about, my parents would tell me the same stories, that they would be, there was a lot more tricking than treating at first. Yeah. I would have someone come out with me like the very first time, but then after that, we were on our own. We were on our own. But we were baby boom. You know, just so darn many of us, we'd eat you if you bothered with us. There were so many children. There were so many swarms of children. Well, now, another question. These are very serious theological questions. Have you decorated your front porch already? Anybody already done it? Yeah, some have already done it. Some will do it later. What have you got? Front porch, what have you got?
Pumpkins.
Are they carved already or are you waiting? Okay, so yeah, some people put the pumpkin out and carve them later.
Right. Yeah. So we've got pumpkins and corn sheaves, and I went out and I got this little
wind spinner thingy.
Okay. It's a witch on a bicycle.
Oh, I've seen her. I've seen her. The witch with the spinning bicycle. Yeah.
We got
a scarecrow. A scarecrow already up.
Okay.
Mr. Bones. Mr. Bones, is that a favorite decoration?
Yes, but right.
Do a lot of the decorations have their own names? Yeah. We had a witch I absolutely love, clearly modeled on Margaret Hamilton from The Wizard of Oz. Poor Margaret, you know, who suffered so much in making that movie, but it was clearly that face, and it was old, and it wouldn't be Halloween without it. It's like certain Christmas ornaments. So do you dress up when you give out candy? Sometimes, what do you dress as, Sandra?
A witch,
yes. Yeah. That sounds like fun. Anyone else? A lot of witches? Those who do dress up? Have we got some witches? Yeah?
Yeah, I have an uncle that put a lot of hours of work to be dressed up as the Wolfman, and he gave it out. And one of the kids asked him if his mom or dad was her.
He was a big kid. I used to sit on a porch and with a great big hat and an eagle mask on and blowing a Mexican clay whistle with a very eerie sound. That was a lot of fun. I really liked that. Pam, my wife, is a witch usually. Now, what do you have any policy about teens? Those teenagers who come without benefit of costume but with a pillowcase.
Uh-huh. It's a trick or treat, and I said trick.
Uh-huh.
And they said, what? I said, if you want your candy, you have to do a trick. And so they did gymnastics on my front lawn.
They did gymnastics, okay. Yeah. I used to get these old codgers who would say, I'm not giving you a treat till you show me a trick. And it had to be a good trick. But anybody else? Any policy with regard to teenagers, Gail? Okay. Yeah, well, teenagers, right. Wait, so what are you supposed to be? I see. The future. And it's scary. Oh, golly. I think that, you know, while I was still a child, costumes had become a convenience. The real thing for me was going out. But I lived on the edge of the woods, seriously. So those last houses were in a deep, dark forest preserve where we really had an old woman who lived in a hut. And kids used to bring her groceries, and you know, she'd probably been there since the Depression. So yeah, Christmas and Hanukkah and Thanksgiving are so much about ourselves and so much about our families, our own families. But on Halloween, that's the holiday where we get ready for others. The other, the stranger. It's really unique. The strangers who come dressed in their sort of worst best. So sometimes we have no idea who they are, and yet we welcome them. very, very different than the way we feel about the other and the stranger at other times. Anyway, I think it takes a lot of courage for kids to go up to that first door and ring the bell or knock, or to any door really, especially if they've heard the story of Hansel and Gretel. It takes a lot of trust. With a strange house, candy, older people, and darkness all around, when that door opens, who knows what might happen? We come into the world. There's someone who just came into the world recently. We come into the world awfully helpless, really awfully helpless. And our memory of that never really goes away. Lots of things remind us of that feeling. Stories, nursery rhymes, TV shows, and movies. Of all the movies that my parents never should have taken me to see, The Time Machine was the worst. It came out, some people are nodding, some people are probably right around that age too. It came out in the summer of 1960 when I wasn't quite 7 and my sister not quite 8. We were both scared, but she got over it quickly. After all, her bedroom was right next to our parents' bedroom. I had to sleep in a room built over the garage on the other side of a deep, dark stairwell that took a turn and then ended right by the door to the even deeper, darker basement stairs. So my room was more on a direct line to the basement instead of a direct line to Mom and Dad. Well, The Time Machine was based on H.G. Wells' 1895 novella, in which he introduced the modern idea of time travel. A wealthy London gentleman, who's also a dilettante scientist, builds the machine in his home lab and uses it to transport himself to the same spot 800,000 years in the future. Where his British home had stood, he finds a lush tropical landscape and a very different social scene. The human family has become divided into two groups. He first meets the Eloi, who live in pleasant group homes like summer garden structures, open to the mild air, no doors or windows. They appear to do no work at all. The Eloi are youthful, they're cute, rather small. In the movie, they're all blonde with pageboy haircuts. None seem older than 23, 24. When they aren't lounging, they play various sorts of games, though they're not at all athletic. They have no books and no real motivation. Their food is all fruit, some of it starchy, but all of it sweet. They have no electric lights, but when it's dark, it's darker than you could know. The dark is where the Morlocks live, the other side of humanity, underground, on the other side of things. It's the Morlocks who provide the Eloi's food. They retain some sort of technology and industry that produces clothing for the surface dwellers and the buildings where they dwell. The time traveler can hear the sounds of the Morlocks' machines thrumming everywhere beneath the gardens and the pavilions of the surface where the Eloi pass their time, as if unaware of their neighbors. H.G. Wells described the Morlocks as pale and covered with long white hair. The movie added blue skin and eyes that glowed red in the dark. Either way you picture them, compared to the Eloi, they are unmistakably old. White hair. They can't stand fire or daylight, but come up at night from the basement of the world, bringing things that the Eloi might require: clothing, bowls, cups. They return underground before dawn, carrying what they need from the surface. They also steal the time machine. So the time traveler climbs down a ventilation shaft to look for it. In a dark corridor, he finds some meat on a metal table and wonders. He's seen no trace of any large animals in the upper world. And then he realizes what kind of meat it must be. Do you? In exchange for being housed, clothed, and fed, the Eloi must eventually be eaten. That's why none are older than 20-something. Well, a sophisticated author like H.G. Wells was reflecting on British class society and a host of other issues, of course, but what my child's eyes saw was this: the old feeding on the young. What my child's ears heard was the sound of the furnace or the washing machine or the sump pump down in the basement of our house, thrumming just like the Morlocks machines in the movie. What if they were down there? Would they come upstairs to get me in the dark? They couldn't be real, but what if they were? The best plan was probably never to go to sleep again. At least not in my own bed. I would slip in as quietly as I could next to my sister, uncertain if the adults could be trusted. Morlock. Was there some connection? The old, feeding on the young. It's one of our most ancient fears. Think about it. We enter a world where everyone is bigger than us and exponentially stronger. They do so many things we can't. How they make or manage what they do is beyond our comprehension. So much of it seems to happen, if not in real darkness, at least where we can't see. Stuff appears as if by magic, and then it disappears without a trace. Maybe I'll be next. With luck, they'll choose my sister, since she's bigger. But I'll be alone the next time, then, when they come back for me. It's easy to turn all this around. Hansel and Gretel don't eat the witch, but they are the ones who cook her. And do you remember how the tale begins? The stepmother is worried that feeding the children will cause the adults to starve. She's their stepmother, so she never nursed them, but it's easy to share her concern about the young feeding on the old. If we live long enough, a time comes when most of us become infirm. We need help doing many things that we used to do for ourselves. Excuse me. Now we may need help with clothing and shelter, and also with our food. What's to prevent younger folks from taking our money, our homes, and leaving us to starve? The old feeding on the young feeding on the old. Certain voices feed both fears, especially in election years. To the young, they say, look at those old geezers taking it easy while you slave away in a world they've drained of riches. Why should you take care of them? To older folks, they say, you've worked hard all your life to build your pretty home, and now these lazy kids, many of them here illegally, are nibbling at the corners, gobbling up what they never helped to make. Remember Joan Lindbergh's poem, maybe they'll bump you off for your pearls. Just like Hansel and Gretel's stepmother, they won't do it directly. They'll just slip your name to one of those death panels, take you to the doctor, and you'll never find your way home. The story of Hansel and Gretel tells us that such fears and tensions between old and young are nothing new. At the time of the prophet Muhammad, female infanticide was common in Arabia. Some family member would take an unwanted newborn girl somewhere out of town, dig a little hole, cover her with a little soil, and then leave. The problem was solved, and you hadn't technically committed a murder since you'd left the child alive, like the stepmother did when she left Hansel and Gretel in the woods. You can find different variations of this practice all around the world at any point in time. Muhammad had been a caravan trader who often camped in the wild. Maybe he had come across the remains of such children. Maybe more than once. So when someone asked him, one, what's the worst possible thing that a human being can do? And two, after that, What's the next worst thing? Logical. He answered, not surprisingly, that the worst thing was idolatry or polytheism. But right after that came killing your children for fear they might join you in food. The first is a crime against divinity. The second violates humanity. Periods of scarcity have been a fact of human life since the beginning, just as they were for our pre-human ancestors and all living creatures. Those might kill their offspring when food is scarce, or even use their young for food. But if we do the same, we won't be truly human. Our humanity is defined by certain lines of trust. What do you make of the humanity of the witch in our fairy tale? How about the stepmother? How about the woodcutter? The children's father? He's a piece of work, isn't he? The version of Hansel and Gretel that I shared with the children earlier is very close to what you would find in the classic collection of Grimm's fairy tales. But there's an important difference that I'd like to share with you now. It comes in the scene after the children have defeated the witch and filled their pockets with her jewels and gold, but now find that they have to cross a large body of water in order to get home. In the version I read to the kids, a duck appears to ferry them across and they both hop on her back. But Grimm's version tells us something different. It says, the good-natured duck came near the bank, so close that Hansel could seat himself and wanted to take his little sister on his lap. But she said, no, we shall be too heavy for the kind duck. Let her take us over one at a time. The good creature did as the children wished. She carried Gretel over first and then came back for Hansel. You would think that after facing such terrors as being abandoned and lost and captivity in the house of the child-eating witch, these kids would cling to each other with grim determination. But instead, they're willing and able to trust. To trust yet another stranger. To trust each other and to trust that things will now work out. Hansel's comfortable enough to stand for a while alone and not quite out of the woods. It's a bit like the first time you go up all by yourself on Halloween to ring a stranger's doorbell with no one by your side. That's an important moment. I think that of all the brave things these kids have done, this is one of the bravest. Soon they'll get home to their father. They're tough little things, but they still need care. They'll need to trust him again in all his flawed humanity. And they're ready to do so. And that may be the bravest thing of all. It's the real triumph, much greater than their triumph over the witch. The story has also killed off the stepmother, so we trust that the kids will be safe in the future, though the story doesn't take us there. I think it looks brighter than the poem I shared imagines it to be. It's a good poem, but much too grim for what's really such a joyful holiday. I look forward to Halloween again this year. Though partisan campaigns may work to divide us, this funny little autumn holiday does so much to bring us together. It takes trust to go to a doorstep that's festooned with bats and spiders and skeletons, and to take candy from stranger after stranger. It's just the opposite of what you do on a normal day, let alone after dark. It takes a lot of trust for kids to do it. It takes a lot for adults to let them. And in spite of what we may be hearing to the contrary, a lot more trust is exactly what we need. So may it be.